Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Hannah, and I'm very excited to be hosting What in the World, a new daily podcast from the BBC World Service, where we try to help you make sense of the world around you, of the big things that are happening, the small things that are happening, and everything in between. Just search for What in the World wherever you get your BBC podcasts and hit subscribe.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 3rd of August, these are our main stories. Major cities in Niger are facing rolling blackouts after Nigeria cut electricity supplies to the country following last week's coup. Donald Trump is due to appear in court in Washington later today, charged with trying to overturn the 2020 presidential election results. Brazilian police have shot dead at least 10 people in Rio in the latest of a series of deadly raids across the country. Also in this podcast,
we could see that we detected more cancers without increasing the false positives, and at the same time, we can reduce the workload for the breast radiologists.
A study from Sweden suggests that screening for breast cancer could be transformed by the use of artificial intelligence. We begin in West Africa. Major cities in Niger are facing rolling blackouts after Nigeria cut electricity supplies to the country following last week's coup. The West Africa regional bloc ECOWAS imposed trade and financial sanctions on Niger on Sunday, giving the coup leaders a week to install the country's democratically elected president. A delegation from ECOWAS has been sent to Niger to negotiate with the coup leaders, and military representatives from the group are meeting in the Nigerian capital Abuja to discuss the situation. Nigeria's Chief of Defence Staff, Christopher Gwabin Musa, told the meeting that African countries must act together.
The events that transpired in one of our countries on 26 July 2023 has reverberated across our borders, affecting us all. The recent coup d'etat in the Republic of Niger is one event that calls for our collective attention and a united response. We must face the challenges of restoring democratic governance in Niger head-on, drawing on our shared experiences, wisdom, and collective resolve.
Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, told me more about the current negotiations.
These talks are ongoing, we think, for at least another day. And basically, these defence officials are saying that the military option in Niger is the very last resort, but they're saying it is still on the table. And they're really using a sort of carrot and stick method here. You've got the ECOWAS, this West African regional grouping, saying, look, you have got to hand back power to the president of Niger, Mohamed Bazoum, or there is a risk of military intervention. But at the same time, they've sent in a delegation to have talks with those military people who have seized power in Niger. And there are efforts led by the former Nigerian military ruler, Abdul Salam Abubakar, who's taken part in negotiations before. He's in Niger, along with the Sultan of Sokoto, the most senior Muslim cleric in Nigeria, who has quite a lot of clout in the region. So it's a kind of carrot and stick approach, but they're certainly saying for now that military option is still there on the table in case power is not returned to the president of Niger.
And what effect are these sanctions and the power outages having on the people in Niger?
Well, we've already seen queues at banks. There's a limit on how much money can be taken out. That's partly because of financial restrictions imposed by ECOWAS through its bank. We're also hearing about lorries full of produce having to turn back and go back to Niamey, those lorries that were trying to leave the country. And then perhaps significantly, as you mentioned, the blackouts, because Nigeria exports quite a lot of electricity to Niger. And by cutting off that power, that's going to hurt people. people and really hurt businesses a lot. So the hope, if that's what Nigeria has done officially, the hope is that that'll put pressure on people not to follow behind the military leaders who've seized power and support them, but instead to stand up and say, come on, we need another way. The military rule in Niger is not the way to go.
Will Ross. So what is life like for people in Niger at the moment? Christian Fraser spoke to Sadisu Sani, the chair of the Association of Niger's Municipalities in Maradi, a region that borders Nigeria. With no electricity, he had to do his interview in his car.
The owners of business are trying their best. You know, our people are very resilient here. So business is going on, not normally, but is going on with a lot of concern, a lot of anxiety, I would say.
Well, a lot of concern and anxiety, I would think, with no electricity. I mean, what does that mean to the local economy where you are?
To the local economy, already prices are going high. Food products, electrical gadgets, because of the power cuts. And life is beginning to become more difficult. It is already difficult, you know, in this part of the world. We are fighting insecurity, poverty, and all those the problems that you know. But now it's like things are becoming harder for people.
Mr. Sani, you're an elected official.
Yes, you
are, right. So I don't want to put you unduly on the spot because of the situation in the country, but I wonder how you feel about the change in leadership. Was it necessary?
It isn't. In fact, we were shocked. Everybody knows it. Niger were battling with a lot of problems, but I think the government was doing relatively well. Relatively in the region, and even compared to other governments that were there before, and people are not complaining to that level. You know, we're in a democratic process, so people will be complaining. They do complain everywhere if they're all right. So I don't see any reason for this coup from and my people. The people I'm with are shocked.
Sadisu Sani. Next to Senegal. The country is seeing a surge in migrants attempting the Atlantic route to reach Spain's Canary Islands. Almost 800 people have died or gone missing during the first half of the year, according to a Spanish NGO, making it one of the deadliest sea routes for migrants worldwide. But despite the dangers, many young people attempt to make the crossing over and over again. Sierra Thierry reports from Senegal, and some may find the following distressing.
We're at a popular beach in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. A typical afternoon, but only at first sight. Just hours before, firefighters were pulling bodies out of the sea. At least 17 migrants have drowned here on their way to Europe. Their capsized boat still drifting in the distance.
We saw the bodies with our own eyes, our brothers. We all cried so much.
Momodou Bari, a nearby fisherman, tells me.
But there is nothing here in Dakar. Everyone is dreaming of going to Europe. I've been working for years, but all I've got is £6 in my pocket.
In Mbour, a fishing village just 2 hours south of Dakar, around 100 wooden boats line up along the beach. They should be out at sea, but there's no one here to drive them. Their captains have left for Spain.
I'm in a neighborhood where several families have lost a husband or a son. But many fishermen tell me they'd rather die at sea than not try at all.
Sally Osea is taking water out of his pirogue. A young father of six, he has set out to reach the Canary Islands 3 times already and almost died at sea. Yet he's getting ready to try again.
I have no other choice but to leave. I have to take care of everyone in their daily lives.
But he says ever since big foreign vessels started fishing along Senegal's coasts, his nets have come back empty. Youth unemployment is soaring in Senegal, and those who make it to Europe reinforce the idea that life is better there.
This needs to stop. It's not benefiting anyone for you to disappear in the sea like dead flies.
In a suburb of Dakar, Mustafa Diouf is talking to a group of young men. He too went to Spain, but returned home and now warns others about the dangers of the sea crossing and the false promises about Europe.
You should stay here, even though things are bad. If you keep looking, you will find something here. If you cross to Europe, you're going there just to be unemployed.
Yet later at night, when it's dark and the beaches are empty, some of them will come back to this very spot and wait for a pirogue that might take them to Spain. Dying at sea, they say here, is better than dying next to our mum.
That report by Sira Thierry in Senegal. Supporters of Donald Trump are rallying around the former president after he was indicted on four charges relating to alleged attempts to overturn the result of the 2020 election. His campaign team have accused the U.S. Justice Department of interference in next year's presidential poll and compared Mr. Trump's treatment to the persecution inflicted in Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. The charges are the most serious levelled against Mr. Trump so far, with each count carrying a maximum sentence of between 5 and 20 years in prison. He is due in court later today. Six co-conspirators have also been listed in the indictment. From Washington, here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
Donald Trump's supporters and allies have been rallying to his defence, claiming he's being unfairly targeted to try and stop him getting back into the White House, and also that the latest charges against him will increase his popularity. Mr. Trump's former lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, is believed to be one of the co-conspirators who's described in the indictment as helping Mr. Trump try to subvert the election results. He argues it's not illegal to claim the 2020 election was fraudulently stolen.
What they did here is an abomination that will live in history as one of the worst violations of free speech ever in the history of a country that used to value free speech more than any country on earth. We can't say that anymore.
Donald Trump frequently complains that the Biden administration has weaponized the justice system to persecute him. The U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland insists many steps were taken to ensure an entirely impartial investigation.
Immediately after the January 6th attack on our democracy, the career men and women of the Justice Department engaged in what has become the largest investigation in our history. In November last, I appointed Jack Smith, special counsel, to take on the ongoing investigation in order to underline the department's commitment to accountability and independence. Mr. Smith and his team of experienced, principled career agents and prosecutors have followed the facts and the law wherever they lead.
Donald Trump insists he will continue his presidential campaign even if he's convicted and jailed for trying to overturn the results of the last election. His supporters are convinced he'll be found innocent and re-elected.
He's going to beat the case. I think it's helping his popularity. Most people believe he's a martyr, just being persecuted, and I think they'll get more votes.
The Democrats, their new playbook is to whoever the Republican nominee is, they're going to try to press criminal charges on him.
Mr. Trump's next court appearance will be in Washington. Next year, he'll have to fit his election campaign around a busy schedule of court dates.
Sarah Smith. A jury in the United States has sentenced to death a gunman who murdered 11 people at a synagogue in the U.S. city of Pittsburgh. Seven other people, including five police officers, were injured when Robert Bowers opened fire at the Tree of Life synagogue 5 years ago. The federal jury agreed unanimously that he should be executed. It's the first federal death sentence imposed under the Biden administration. Jewish organizations have welcomed the verdict as a sign that the United States will not tolerate hate and violence towards followers of their faith or any other. Gene Klickner is a member of the synagogue and was there on the day of the massacre.
I don't even know what to say about the verdict because it's not a happy day. The room was quiet. Nobody was reacting. There's nothing to report. Everyone's just sitting there listening, and even at the end, I don't think there was a big gasp or out anything. Yeah, it's terrible. It's really tough.
Jamie Raskin is a Democratic congressman from Maryland. He gave his reaction to the death sentence.
I have opposed the death penalty for a long time, and I led the fight in Maryland to abolish the death penalty. You know, I think that the punishment of death is certainly way too good for the mass murderer, this racist anti-Semite who assassinated worshipers at the Tree of Life synagogue. And, you know, he should be forced to endure his days with the rigors of a hard time in prison. And he should be an example to others. You know, a lot of these people who engage in these massacres at churches, supermarkets, Walmarts, what have you, turn the gun on themselves and kill themselves. They don't want to face a guilty verdict and life in prison. So that's my feeling about it. But, you know, I think this is obviously the best case for the death penalty when you have unreconstructed Nazis who are essentially, you know, setting themselves at war against humanity. But I still think that civilization can evolve beyond the death penalty.
Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin. Police in Brazil say at least 10 people have been killed in a police operation in Rio. Three others were hurt. Warren Ball reports.
A military police spokesman said officers had returned fire during an operation targeting criminal gangs in a slum area in the north of Rio called Complexo da Penha. Officers say they acted after receiving intelligence on a high-level meeting involving gang leaders and that two of the people killed were heads of local favela. Among the items seized were rifles, ammunition and grenades. Since Friday, more than 40 people have been killed in police operations in Brazil, 14 of them in clashes in São Paulo state. That prompted an intervention by Brazil's Justice Minister, Flavio Dino, who said the police reaction was not proportional to the crime committed.
Warren Ball. A study from Sweden suggests that screening for breast cancer could be transformed by the use of artificial intelligence. The trial involved more than 80,000 women from Sweden with an average age of 54. Johnny Diamond spoke to the lead author, Dr. Christina Long, from Lund University.
In this trial, we randomised women to AI-supported screening and to normal screening. And normal screening is when two radiologists read each screening exam. And we found some really exciting results because we could see that we detected more cancers without increasing the false positives. And at the same time, we can reduce the workload for the breast radiologist reading their screening examination by almost half. This is the first randomized controlled trial where we see what actually happens when you use this in practice. Previous studies have been so-called retrospective studies where you analyze AI on already collected images. So they can give some hint on what the result would be when you use it in clinical practice, but it's only an approximation of the truth. To do a randomized controlled trial is getting closer to what the truth is.
So how much, crudely put, radiologist time do you think you might be able to save with the use of AI?
Actually, quite a lot, because, I mean, it takes not a lot of time to read one screening examination. So it can take less than 1 minute. But put together, we can say that maybe on average, a radiologist or radiographer read 50 screening examinations per hour. So if we could halve the screen reading burden with AI, we could save substantial time. So for the 40,000 women that were in this AI-supported group, we calculated that we could save almost 5 months of radiologist time.
The inevitable question, and one which radiologists, junior radiologists might themselves might fear, is if it's this good, why do you have any humans involved at all?
This trial that we designed, it was really emphasized the central role of the radiologist, because as the AI algorithms are currently, they cannot be used as a standalone method because they are too sensitive. They react to too many findings in the images. So the radiologist have to make the final decision whether a woman should be recalled or not, because the big risk is that if we use AI alone, it will lead to too many false positives.
Is this a time saver or is it a life saver or is it both?
Well, it's definitely a time saver. And whether it's a lifesaver, that remains to be seen. So my hope is that using AI and screening will lead to a screening program with a higher effect, that we can further reduce the mortality of breast cancer. And so far, we can see that we detect 20% more cancer. So it's very promising, but that we have to put the whole picture together. What type of cancers do we detect and how many cancers do we miss? So in order to get the full picture, we need to wait for this 2-year follow-up period to get more data on that.
Dr. Christina Long from Lund University in Sweden. Still to come, it was a great day for Jamaica and South Africa at the Women's World Cup. But was their success despite the support they receive?
These women deserve to have backing and funding regardless. And there's really no excuse for these federations not to be backing and really supporting these women who are representing their country equal to the men.
From the passion of the fans.
Yes, and what did you think of the match though?
Oh, the match was amazing. It was so nice to see so many Nigerians coming up.
To the atmosphere of the competition.
The game, the crowd, the atmosphere was absolutely amazing. I am now a converted New Zealand fan.
World Football at the Women's World Cup is the podcast from the BBC World Service capturing all the excitement of the tournament here in Australia and New Zealand. Listen now by searching for World Football wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The Greek government is offering free holidays to anyone who had a visit to the island of Rhodes cut short by wildfires. More than 20,000 people had to flee the island last month. Now, the Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis says those tourists, whose vacations were affected by the fires, can go back to Rhodes next year for free. I asked our Europe regional editor Paul Moss why he might be in the mood for such generosity.
There is a famous saying, beware of Greeks bearing gifts. I should say we don't have any details yet from the Greek Prime Minister, Mr. Mitsotakis. One assumes that he's offering free accommodation, though who knows, maybe he's planning to fly people out to Rhodes for free and throw in a few portions of moussaka and a bottle of ouzo as well. But there is, I think, a reasoning behind this. Greece relies on tourism. It's a key part of their economy. And Rhodes in particular needs tourists for financial survival. They're very worried that those fires will put people off coming. Travel agents have launched a whole campaign with this title, Rhodes is Safe. And they've even got a campaign video which they've posted online with a sort of jaunty piece of music to accompany it. Now, when you watch this video, I have to admit it's quite a cliche of a holiday advert. We see bikini-clad bathers lounging lethargically in a pool, a few more adventurous types diving off a pier. And then there are shots of a few ancient Greek ruins as well. And over all of this, there's this caption, Rhodes is safe.
Will this work?
I'm not really certain that reassuring people that Rhodes is safe can do anything except remind people that it might not be safe. I mean, if you were to get on an aeroplane and the captain said over the intercom, fasten your seatbelts and don't worry, this plane won't crash, you might actually feel rather alarmed and wonder, well, who said it would crash? I mean, most holiday destinations go with slogans like, come to Kenya, we have amazing wildlife, or come to Ibiza, you can get off your head and dance all night. What they don't say is, come to this resort and we're pretty sure you won't get caught up in an out-of-control wildfire. Being serious, though, the problem they have on Rhodes, indeed a problem they could soon have at holiday destinations across southern Europe, is that these wildfires are becoming ever more common. Do people want to risk going on holiday in a disaster zone? And isn't that ironic? Because tourism encourages people to get on planes, which then blast out carbon dioxide, contribute to global heating, and then that self-same global heating may mean that those destinations become insufferably hot, not to mention at risk of burning down.
Paul Moss. Scientists say a strange, dangerous habit of targeting and ramming into small boats is spreading through a population of critically endangered orcas. Research shows that 20 of the fewer than 60 Iberian orcas in the Atlantic have now learned the behaviour. It's believed that one or two of the animals started interacting with and damaging vessels 3 years ago, along the coast of Spain, Portugal, and the Strait of Gibraltar. Our science correspondent Victoria Gill reports.
The sound of a nervous sailing crew in Gibraltar as five orcas nudge, ram and spin their yacht around. This incident in July is one of at least 100 this year, and scientists are trying to work out what's driving this strange new habit of targeting and damaging sailing boats. Researchers have studied footage and photographs of some of the latest encounters between sailing vessels and orcas and concluded that up to 20 animals in this small population have now learned to do this by copying others.
It's only a game. It's not revenge. It's not climate change or nothing like that. It's just game and that's it.
Dr. Renard De Stefanis is president of a marine conservation organisation in southern Spain. He's studied this critically endangered population of Iberian orcas since the 1990s. He says the animals appear to focus their attention on the boat's rudder. In this underwater recording, you can hear an orca shove the vessel's rudder with its head. Dr. De Stefanis and his colleagues are currently attaching satellite tracking tags to the animals' fins to map their movements.
Thanks to the satellite tagging, we're able to know exactly how to say the sailing boat and motorboat to leave the area and to not cross the main area of the killaways.
As large and powerful as these marine mammals are, scientists and conservationists are concerned that they're putting themselves at risk, as well as testing our willingness to share the ocean with its wildlife.
Victoria Gill. It was an extraordinary day at the Women's World Cup, as both Jamaica and South Africa caused huge upsets to reach the last 16. South Africa beat Italy 3-2, thanks to a last-minute goal in Wellington. And the Jamaicans, who wrote an open letter before the tournament complaining about a lack of support from the country's football federation, knocked out Brazil following a 0-0 draw in Melbourne to become the first Caribbean nation to progress from the group stage. I asked the former New Zealand World Cup footballer Rebecca Smith, who's in Sydney, how important it was for the game to see both South Africa and Jamaica make progress in the tournament.
This is amazing, Nigel. It's not only the fact that they've got out of their groups, but they've done it in style. They've done it showing that they can play and compete with some of the best teams on the world stage, including Brazil, as we saw Jamaica last night. And Jamaica has not conceded a goal in this tournament. And that is a feat in and of itself. Specifically for South Africa as well, we don't often see the African countries doing that well, progressing into the deeper stages of the tournament. And looking at the lack of funding and some of the issues that both the Jamaican and South African teams have had coming into this tournament, specifically Jamaica, where they were pretty much stuck in Amsterdam on the way down to the tournament looking for funding, where Sadella Marley was looking at crowdfunding and trying to get some money to get them back all the way down to the tournament. You just wonder what these teams could do when their federations would actually back them.
Do you hope that their progress will be a wake-up call for both the federations involved here and others who maybe don't give women's football the respect it possibly should deserve in their country?
Do you know what's really sad, Nigel? It shouldn't be that the backing and the funding of the federation is dependent on the success of the national teams. These national teams have worked hard. These women deserve to have backing and funding regardless. They are getting more money from FIFA for preparation money ahead of the tournament for the very first time in this edition. And there's really no excuse for these federations not to be backing, funding their national teams properly, and really supporting these women who are representing their country equal to the men who are doing that. So yeah, it's unfair. It's not a positive situation, but I think that the fact that they are winning is waking the country up and potentially rallying a lot more of the population to force the federation's hand into funding them and into supporting them more, which can only be a good thing.
Rebecca Smith in Sydney. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.